But first, Steve Gorman. He's the co-founder and drummer of the legacy rock group The Black Crowes. The band topped the charts and dominated the radio airwaves in the early 90s with their bluesy, Rolling Stones-ish swagger, selling over 30 million albums. However, they were also known as much for their dysfunction as for their music. Much of the friction came from the constant fighting between Crowes frontman Chris Robinson and his younger brother Rich. Gorman writes about the band's ups and downs in a memoir called Hard to Handle: The Life and Death of the Black Crowes, where he talks about meeting Chris Robinson for the first time in 1987.
My first impression of him at the time, my immediate thought was that he looked like Emo Phillips, who was at the height of his career, I believe, at that point.
Yeah.
He was just a super skinny, big-nosed, rubber-faced guy with a clear sense of humor and a great wit, which was on display immediately. So we hit it off right away. You know, we had different but complementary senses of humor, if you will. So we found ourselves getting along right from the jump.
Mm-hmm. What did you think the first time you saw the Robinson brothers on stage? What did you think of them?
Chris was, you know, his that manic energy of his, I just couldn't imagine how that translated into someone on stage.
Mm.
But it did. And in fact, he wasn't performing much as he was standing in place trying desperately to get a point across. And I don't even know if he knew the point. But there was an energy and a very real vibe from the minute I saw Mr. Crowes Garden to that singer. Now, his brother, who was playing guitar, had the exact opposite effect. He was invisible and trying to be even more invisible. There was literally no performance value in what he was doing. And he just had his head down and played the songs, and it was workmanlike and completely detached from any passion that his brother might be eliciting from what he was doing. So it was a real dichotomy. You know, it was really good based on, I mean, for my understanding of the world in 1987 and having been in town exactly one day, I thought they were fantastic.
Mm. What was the dynamic between Chris and Rich like?
Like, I mean, not unlike any sets of brothers. I mean, I have brothers myself. I've always known brothers, and you can see a closeness and an intimacy between them that was expressed in ways unlike any I'd ever seen. They were very condescending to each other. They were also very, I mean, nobody else could, you could not badmouth either one to the other without them defending their brother, but they would destroy each other like clockwork. I mean, they were at each other's throats until someone else got involved, and then they had each other's back. But only until that point would they ever align and show support to the other.
Mm, so that must have made for like a very tense, difficult working relationship, right?
It did. And, you know, in a local band when you first start, and I knew, you know, it was funny because a few months later when Chris talked to me about joining the band, my first thought was, no way, I'm not getting in between two brothers. That's a suicide mission.
Mm.
And I knew that. And yet I still did it. But for a few years as a local band, we would have blow-ups and we would have arguments and I would get caught in the middle and then I'd be arguing with one or the other of them or both. But in a local band, you do that and then you don't see each other for 3 days.
Mm.
That all ends when you put an album out and tour for, you know, for a year and a half straight. And then that culture finds itself and then suddenly that becomes your new normal.
So let's talk about putting this album out. The first album you ever drum on is the Black Crowes' 1990 hit debut album, Shake Your Moneymaker. What was that like for you?
You know, I at the time it seemed perfectly normal because when you're that age, everything you do, you go, well, yeah, this makes sense. Looking mm-hmm. back now, it's completely absurd. You know, I bought a drum kit in March and less than 3 years later, I had an album in stores. And
yeah.
So, but the learning curve is so steep when you're young and starting in a band. We had talent. Chris, Rich, and I all had clearly skills. We didn't know what to do with them. We hadn't developed them yet, but it was all there. The building blocks were in place. We just had to, or they existed. We had to figure out how to put them in place.
Mm.
And I don't know that we ever would have if we hadn't met George Drakoulias, who signed our band and then produced the first two albums. Whatever it was about George that, and we had met other people from other labels before and never felt a single connecting point. With George, it was like he joined the band right off the bat. We all, Chris and Rich and I felt that from that first night.
How are the Robinson brothers handling all of this success?
We were, the best thing was we were way too busy to spend a whole lot of time thinking about it on the first album. That's an overriding statement for everybody. But with Chris, it was difficult after a while. You know, when you go out and promote an album, he was the guy going into a radio station every day in every city. He's the guy doing every interview. And it was a tremendous workload for someone who's not naturally suited to be charming and on his A game and try to, you know, promotion is not something he was born to do, if you will. He's very good at it when he wants to be. But eventually he really chafed under the scheduling, and he just got sick of repeating himself. Mm-hmm. And which I understand.
Yeah.
At the same time, he was very reluctant to share the load because he wanted to be the guy.
Yeah.
Rich, whose skill set is the exact opposite, Rich also wanted to be able to involve himself with that, but he didn't have a natural gift for the gab. He was never very good at that. And again, when I talk about my strengths and weaknesses, more importantly for the band, and I talk about this a lot in the book, the band had inherent great strengths. The band had inherent weaknesses. And by the time our second album was in the can, the biggest flaw in the Black Crowes was we consistently ignored where those lines were. And we forgot what our strengths were. In a desire to do everything, we did a lot of things we probably weren't perfectly suited to do.
Mm. What was your rock and roll bottom with the Black Crowes? Can you point to like a worst moment?
For me personally, it came in Tokyo in 1992, where the everything just finally hit the wall. I thought I couldn't stay in the band anymore. And this is right when our second record was released. I sort of had a breakdown very early. We weren't the kind of band that could talk about how we were feeling on a day-to-day basis. You got up, you put on your armor, and you made sure you didn't turn your back on anybody. You know, it was really like that in that band, because the mood could turn against you at any moment.
Yeah.
And again, that becomes familiar. And then in short order, that familiarity becomes comfort. Mm-hmm. You get confused just because you understand it and recognize it. Once you lose sight of the fact that it's not right and shouldn't be that way, but it's more comfortable, then you're dealing with a codependent relationship. Any family with addiction understands this.
She never mentions the word addiction in certain company.
I was having like nightmares, horrific visions at all times. I was really in a bad place. And I looked out my window and I saw that I could actually open it. And I thought, I just want to jump. If I just jumped, this would go away. And thankfully, my immediate second thought was, oh my God, what are you doing? And it made me, I threw up. I got sick right there in my room. Like, the fact that I admitted to myself that I just had that thought made me physically ill. Hmm. And so I, you know, and a lot of this was fueled by Chris Robinson and how he was acting and treating everybody. And then, you know, he's dropping a bomb and then everybody else picks it up and dispenses pieces of it without knowing they're doing. You know, the very essence of our band's community was toxic. Mm-hmm. And I just couldn't take it anymore. So I went and talked to him about it. We had a long, multi-hour conversation where we aired out everything. And I came away feeling relieved and at least like I'd staved off disaster. And, you know, I don't know how he came away from that, but I know that all those things, nothing, if anything, all I did was I pumped the brakes on the runaway toxicity for myself there, but I don't think I did anybody else any favors, because nothing was going to stop that band from careening down the track it was on.
So the band releases some more records and has some more ups and downs. And then in 1999, you play with Led Zeppelin guitar god Jimmy Page. This collaboration leads to the release of a live album and an extensive tour with Jimmy Page in the summer of 2000. What was it like playing with him?
It was the absolute thrill as a musician, but also just as a guy. Jimmy and I got along very well. He was so wonderful and warm and gracious to the band. from the first time we met him in 1995, he was like that. By the time we played shows with him in 99 and 2000, we felt a very real kinship. And that experience, it really was great for the Black Crowes internally as well. It was great for the Black Crowes in that our career was really sagging and suddenly the world remembered that we were a good band.
Yeah.
It wasn't as if I were playing with the members of Led Zeppelin. It was my band and all of us doing what we do very comfortably with Jimmy Page added. And that was the best of all worlds.
Yeah. But then the tour with Jimmy Page is suddenly cut short. Why?
Jimmy had, he had a bad back. He had a back situation that he was in a lot of pain, and we were unaware of how bad that was for him. He was really grinning and bearing it for us, and because he was having a good time. And he understood how important this tour was and our association was for the future of the Black Crowes. He was well aware of that, and he was very happy to be providing us with such a lifeline, which is what he was doing. It still struck us as a little odd that it came without warning that the tour was over. We had played the Jay Leno, the Tonight Show with him, walked off stage, and the next night we had a gig down in Orange County, and I walked off the stage at the Tonight Show to my manager telling me, the tour's over, Jimmy's going home. No one ever had any understanding and ever got any information from him again about what happened. And so Pete, our manager, and I, we shared with each other, well, somebody did something must have happened to spur this on. And it wasn't until a year and a half later, and he told me a story, which is detailed in the book quite specifically, that he'd had a conversation with Rich Robinson the night before he left the tour. And that conversation made him question, why am I doing this for these guys? Why am I putting up with so much pain? And why am I risking further damage to my back for a situation where this guy clearly doesn't appreciate me?
Yeah.
And it was a staggering, truly earth-shattering conversation to be on the receiving end of.
How did the Black Crowes finally end?
2015 was going to be the 25th anniversary of our first album, and we thought, let's finish this thing off with a 25th anniversary / farewell tour, and mean it for real. Like, let's go out with the intention of playing 100 or 150 shows to say thank you to everybody that had ever supported the band, and we're leaving now, and we're going to try to go out on a high note. We're going to go out with dignity and with respect for all that we'd accomplished, and most importantly to me, for each other. I really wanted to stand on stage or in a dressing room after the last show and shake hands and hug everyone in the band and say, look, it's not been easy, and we've just been killing each other for years, but let's go out on a high. Let's go out with a good feeling. Okay, we did it. We crossed a finish line. All we have to do is determine where the finish line is, and then we can cross it, and we can all go our separate ways. And Chris Robinson, the singer, decided that would be the time to demand the lion's share of all the money that the band earned. And so he sent an email. His wife wrote an email saying that for him to continue, he suggested I be fired from the band. And then he suggested, but then if I wanted to stay, if Rich decided I needed to be in, then he would offer me a salary for the final tour. And then, so that just left he and his brother. And he wasn't suggesting a 50-50 split. He suggested a 75-25 split with his own brother, who he wrote all the songs with.
Wow.
And so, you know, his terms were non-negotiable. And our answer was no. And that was literally the end of the Black Crowes. Then we'll move along. I know this will be awkward, but not for long. 'Cause soon you'll have to sing you songs. I will not forget you. No. Nor will I accept the blame.
Have you heard whether Chris or Rich have read your book? And if they have, do you have any idea what they think of it?
No, I have. I doubt they've read it. And if they did get a copy, they won't read it cover to cover. If they do, I would imagine they'd skim it. They'll hear about what's in it from other people.
Yeah.
I don't think either one of them is going to be at all happy with it. But they would never be happy with it regardless of what I wrote. And what they're going to hate is that someone else now has the narrative.
Mm-hmm.
To a sense. Yeah. You know, they're losing control of a narrative that's been spun for years. Most of which, a great degree of which, was just the flight of fancy of one of them, whichever one was talking at the time. And from my perspective, very rarely rooted in reality.
Yeah. Steve Gorman, thank you very much.
Thank you, man. I appreciate it.
Steve Gorman was the drummer and co-founder of the Black Crowes. He's the author of Hard to Handle, The Life and Death of the Black Crowes. Find out more about Steve at WPR.org/beta.
I do love that omelet scene from the end of Big Night because it's symbolic of the healing and connecting power of food.
YouTube chef Andrew Ray on the power of food in cinema and TV. That's coming up in a minute. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio.